The topic tonight is the end of a five-part series where we've been talking about sort of our relationship to the peace process and the demands of peace in the Middle East. And tonight's topic is your taxes, your tithes or offerings, and a foretaste of the peace to come. And I'm going to approach it with a little bit of emphasis on the work that I'm involved in now, Lutheran World Relief, that is the relief and development side of things. Of all the places where Lutheran World Relief is active around the world, and it's 50 years old this year, it began when Lutherans were homeless in Europe after World War II. Of all the places around the world, something like 40 countries, there's one place that's been on the books the whole time. Guess what that is? Palestine. Because as the State of Israel was created and Palestinians were made refugees, Western churches rushed in to help, and the tragedy of it is that they're still helping. And I'd like to have that as a sort of a thread running through what we say tonight. And I'm going to use another element of my work, which is communications media. I'm going to show you parts of two videos, one from almost 50 years ago, and another one from a year or two ago, and have those as sort of the unfortunate bookends of this discussion for us to realize what our taxes and our tithes add up to in that part of the world. The first video, I'm going to show you about 6 minutes of a video made in 1953, and it's called Healing in the Holy Land. You could switch on the machine and let it warm up. Yeah, just that same button. Healing in the Holy Land. And it will make a couple references that I have to explain. It's a video that was made after the Hanover Assembly of the Lutheran World Federation. Every 7 years they have a worldwide assembly. The second assembly was held in Hanover, Germany. So they refer to that once in the segment I'm showing you. And they also talk about Lutheran World Action. Now Lutheran World Action was the fundraising arm behind Lutheran World Relief. It no longer exists, but when you hear that word, you can think of Lutheran World Relief. I'm not showing you part of the film, which I think is problematic, is our view of Arabs. The way they describe it in 1953 is not very palatable. It's sort of like these are humans. We have to prove to ourselves that these are human beings, and then we talk about helping them. Not showing you that part, but you'll get a couple references, especially at the beginning where it says where East meets West, where slave meets free. So watch it. Watch for the kind of ministries that the church in this country was involved with in the early 50s in Palestine. Is it finished with warm-up yet?
Yeah. East meets West, where the slave world presses upon the free. Muslim meets Christian, and for the Jew, an old nation is born anew. And here, where the living word first appeared, is symbolized a challenge to the responsible church. This is the Gethsemane of old. There is, not far from the rustle of these ancient olives, a new agony of human suffering being acted out by unwilling victims. How, far from the quiet councils of Hanover, has Christian love responded to their need? For the answer, you do not have far to go. There are still people living in ruins, held in the grip of poverty, caught in the aftermath of war. Arabs, bereft of land and home and possessions, dwell in tent cities by thousands and thousands. Refugees, always refugees, 800,000 of them, walking the long road that leads to nowhere, lifting their eyes to the hills and finding only rocks. What are they like, these dwellers in tents among the cruel stones? They are people, families, fathers, mothers, babies, children. children, always children. Strangers to us, true. But look, instead of a crown of thorns, barbed wire. Some of them are Christians, most are not. But love makes no distinctions. This challenge of suffering is ours to answer. Yes, the need of the children is compelling. And not the least of our answer to their need is schooling. These are reasonably well off, little as they have in worldly goods, much better off, in fact, than others. Here in the land where the blind were once made by miracle to see, the light of learning is being let in on young lives otherwise condemned to darkness. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Older hands are taught to work in one of our more formal schools. But the hunger of their bodies must be answered too. In the tent cities, among these people who live on the narrow edge of starvation, even this is a rare treat. Your love substitutes this. These people must be fed, and little as it is, fed they are. Lutheran World Action is an instrument of United Nations relief throughout the Holy Land. And UN aid is supplemented, of course, by the outpouring of our own churches when it is time for the daily bread. It is the social illness of war that has made these children suffer. But we reach out the hand of Christian love also to those whose sickness is that of the body itself. Here in one of the hospitals we operate in the Holy Land, that need of the body is answered. Many are those who gather at our polyclinic. Even the smallest receives his measure of loving care. On the Mount of Olives itself, Lutheran World Action cooperating with the United Nations maintains another oasis of healing in the land too full of need. Here, where the Lutheran World Federation holds in trust former German institutions of mercy, your gifts of love are transformed into service to man. The Lutheran World Federation's familiar representative, the beloved and jaunty Edwin Moll, has earned the complete trust of people of differing faiths. They have come to know the Lutheran Federation flag as a symbol of faith in action. For just as important as material relief or technical assistance is the personal touch of Christian people bearing their witness among strangers. In Victoria Hospital, that challenge of service to man in the name of the great physician is firmly met. Trained and skilled technicians who are also persons of Christian commitment carry on their ministry of healing. It isn't just the highest skills that are the significant ones. Even the humblest tasks have their place in the pattern too. And when with your own hands you pack and send offerings of garments, the long arm of Lutheran World Federation helps you to clothe the backs of the naked. So the children are being taught, the hungry fed, the sick ministered to, and the naked clothed.
Stop it there. I'll give you a small test. You can turn on the machine too, thanks. What areas... areas of church ministry did you see there, of church healing and diaconic service, did you see in that film?
Feeding.
Okay. Another one?
Education.
Okay.
Healing.
Okay, we'll say medical.
Just job training separate from education.
Yeah, because they showed literacy. Vocational training. Anything else?
One might argue subservience.
You mean by that charity or keep them down?
Keep them down.
Yeah, well, I won't put that down here.
It's kind of like your poem this morning. Yeah? And who's really poor? And
yeah.
Yeah, it's a balancing act.
We come to some of that a little later in the session. I think it's a good point to keep in mind. We can be gracious at 50 years distance from some of the approach of the video and maybe of the mindset. But I noticed also the blind people. Now, what I did before I came was I just looked in our own files for our Lutheran World Relief's involvement in the Middle East, and I pulled the project sheets from that place. And we have something like 160 projects, partners, projects around the world. I pulled the sheets, and here they are. Augusta Victoria Hospital, the one you saw on the Mount of Olives with that steeple, mm-hmm. in that rather clunky architecture. The architecture style is known as Wilhelmic Byzantine, in case anybody's so, because it was done under Kaiser Wilhelm. Gaza, general program of the MECC, and the general program of the MECC is this, vocational training, education, feeding in times of martial law, in times of curfew by the Israelis, although much smaller than what you would see there. Another one is the West Bank program of the YMCA, therapeutic and vocational, here again, a blind school as well. And then, of course, Augusta Victoria itself. So everything you see there, which are really almost frontline ministries. I mean, what you do after a disaster is still going on 50 years later. And, you know, a lot of faithful people giving a lot of money have continued to support those kind of essentially band-aids. And I don't want to put ourselves down or anybody's money down. But I think it reminds us of sort of the righteous anger of some of the prophets when you get stuck with that kind of a situation. And I'd like to speak a little bit about one of them, Augusta Victoria. It's arguably the finest piece of Lutheran real estate in the world, and the only contender I can think of is Holden Village. Augusta Victoria is a hospital sitting on the Mount of Olives. How many of you have been there?
I've been to the hospital, but I didn't think it was really running full speed. It looked like it was almost empty.
When were you there?
88.
Well, it's had its ups and downs, and right now it's having another down because in the so-called peace process, the UN money is cutting back. The Palestinians haven't organized a health authority, and what they're having to do is ask their overseas partners to keep the place running because it's a UN-funded, Lutheran-managed hospital. And Lutheran money has always kept it going on top of the UN money, and the UN money is going down, the per bed per day thing. It's there, it's running. They have about 100 acres of land on top of the Mount of Olives, and they have lost some of it to an Israeli school, a yeshiva, who managed to buy up an old house in front of them. They occasionally get raided by the police when the police say a rock came from that side of the wall. And they've been in a semi-war situation throughout the Intifada, and still are. And it's something that I think has a symbolism that perhaps, like Holden, you can't put a dollar sign on it. It takes a lot of dollars to keep it there. But for that hospital to remain there, it's the largest church-run Palestinian hospital on the West Bank. It's a ministry to Palestinians who suffer, as we'll see in the next video, in a way, especially in health ways, because of the occupation. Their health is heavily impacted by the occupation. Edwin Mole, the guy you saw in the little beret, they said they called him Jaunty. The Jaunty Edwin Mole. There's a book in the bookstore called Together in Hope, and it's a 50-year history of Lutheran World Relief out this year. And quoted in there was an Arab sheikh, an Arab priest, really, a holy man, who said to Edwin Mole, "We don't mind your kind of Christian who comes over here and tries to help us. But we do mind the Christians who come over here and try to take the holy places." And he was talking about the British general in World War I who thought of his conquest of Palestine as almost a modern crusade, and all the way back to the Crusades, the sense the Muslims have that we are trying to take their holy places from them. And he said, in fact, this sheikh said, "I was so impressed by your, I'm so impressed by your kind of Christianity that I'm sending my son to a Christian school." He was talking about the impact made in his community by Augusta Victoria Hospital. So you get a wonderful crossing of that line between service and witness, where a Muslim holy man feels moved to know more about Christ and or his sons to know more about Christianity because of the witness of this hospital, which I say at the present time is very much threatened. And if you see a special appeal for Augusta Victoria Hospital, this is the context in which it's happening right now. Will it survive this peace process? I mentioned the other LWR projects in that area. I'd like to expand it a little bit and speak of the ELCA presence, and maybe some of you know of other areas. Yeah, Art.
Excuse me, John, when was that hospital first built?
The building goes back to Kaiser Wilhelm's visit in 1898.
Wow.
And it's been used for many things since then. It's been used as a hospital, as far as I know, since World War II. And now there's a German pilgrim center there. And it's a beautiful piece of real estate because the Turks gave it to their German Lutheran allies, buddies, in the time of the Turkish Ottoman regime. And it's a colonial piece of real estate, but it's being used for the survival of the Palestinian people, deep in the heart of what used to be a very Palestinian part, East Jerusalem, which today is surrounded by two belts of Israeli settlements and made into kind of a ghetto, almost a Bantustan, almost an apartheid block of a few Palestinians left, squeezed from all sides as the Israeli settlements ring in East Jerusalem and put a lock on that part of the occupied territories. Just to expand slightly, our tithes, what are we doing with our offerings in that part of the world? We're still doing all these things after 50 years. No word here about sustainable development or about advocacy or, I mean, you have to do these basic things. I'd call it suspended relief or permanent relief or suspended development. You know, you're frozen somewhere between an emergency and a better future. The other two areas I'd like to mention is teaching and awareness. And by teaching, I mean, what do the ELCA people in the region do? They are teachers at a seminary in Cairo, preachers and teachers at a parish in Cairo, and preacher and educator, if you like, of visiting Lutherans and other tourists at the Church of the Redeemer in the Old City. There's a man named John Moline, who was a pastor in Moscow and went from being an international pastor in Moscow to running three refugee camps for Africans left when the Soviet Union collapsed and had no way to get home and no way to live. And he used that expertise now the middle of the West Bank to really say to visiting Lutherans and other Christians who come to his parish, please pay attention to the larger issues of justice and also make sure that your pilgrimage to the ruins of the Holy Land also includes the living stones of the Holy Land, which are the Palestinian Christians. I'm going to tell you one story about this teaching ministry of American Lutherans in the Middle East. How many of you have heard of Al Glock? You don't count. my wife put up her hands. My wife and I had the privilege to know him for 2 or 3 years. His ministry was as a sort of a father of Palestinian archaeology. An ELCA, former an LCA missionary, 67-year-old man in 1991, who was an Old Testament scholar in the Missouri Synod mold. You know, a real solid Old Testament scholar. Okay, aren't they solid Old Testament scholars, the Missouri Synod?
That's the way God wrote it.
He went there to study Old Testament archaeology. But as he worked on that, he began to feel that to study Old Testament archaeology was to be an accomplice to the present-day occupation. Because to dig back through 2,000 years to the part that was your expertise, you had to shovel away and bulldoze away 2,000 years of history. And whose history were those 2,000 years? When were the Jewish people scattered from the Holy Land? In the 70 AD and 130 AD? The vast majority of that time was not a Jewish history. And they were just as interested as any Old Testament scholar, and perhaps more so, to also shovel that away and dig back to the part that validates their claim to the land. And as a good Missouri Synod, and then later AELC, and then
ELCA
scholar, he went to a Missouri Synod school. He began to think that he could no longer do that as a Christian archaeologist. The irony of it, he couldn't study the Old Testament as a Christian archaeologist. So he switched and he became a Muslim archaeologist. In a study of the Muslim layers, because 1,300 of those 2,000 years, all the way back to the years of Muhammad, around 700, is Islamic history. If this is the present day, you know, the year 2000, where we are now, and here's Jesus, and you want to start studying the stuff below Jesus' time to get to the Old Testament, it really troubled him that he was digging through all of the claims of the Palestinians to get to the claims of the Jewish people. So he began to study everything from 700 up after Muhammad. The Islamic armies conquered Jerusalem in the 750s, roughly. And he especially focused on the Ottoman period, which was up until the present day from about the 1600s. And in the process, became sort of the father of Palestinian archaeology. So you have an ELCA missionary, part of this, what we do with our money in the Middle East, becoming a Palestinian archaeologist. And helping to found a department of that at a Palestinian university. Well, one Sunday morning, Monday morning at 6 o'clock, we turned on the BBC in Cyprus where we were living, and they said an American archaeologist had been shot in the West Bank. And we listened carefully, and they included his name. They said Al Glock, a long-serving American archaeologist. Now, to this day, nobody knows who did it. His widow is there. She has tried to continue what she could of his work to try to publish a few things he had unfinished. She hasn't quite succeeded. Once when she was in the States, somebody came into their apartment and trashed his records and about 6,000 slides. So she goes back to their apartment a year after his death on a visit to the States and comes back and finds the thing ransacked. She gets no help real from the American embassy. They're not perhaps, you know, have the time or the interest to go into this. She has slivers of information about who it might have been. The place he was shot is about a mile as the crow flies from the military headquarters for the West Bank that the Israelis maintain, the Israeli military headquarters. It took them 2 hours to get there. They could have been there in 90 seconds by helicopter and about 6 minutes by road. They came 2 hours later. That made them look bad early on. They may not have been involved. We can't say they were, but for us, as the small Lutheran family in the Middle East, it was an experience of the lack of law, you know, life without law, life without justice, life without recourse, which the Palestinians experience every day. The fact that a hardworking, committed 67-year-old man murdered in cold blood on a Sunday afternoon, nothing can be said about why he died or who did it, or what his family will ever be able to know about his case. And I share it with you as an example of a unique teaching ministry among the Palestinians. And in fact, since he died, it seems that they have not been able to continue the work that he have continued. So Palestinians as a people have no longer this particular advocate for them in saying, reminding the world that if you look at the Statute of Limitations on who has the claim to this land, there's a lot to be said about these layers here. You can't go back 2,000 years and start making your case. And you have to think about what exists since that time. Any comments or questions? Yeah.
Reminds me of the book, The Source. In the book, The Source by Mishner, you start out with that bullet and you go all the way down. And the history is, a lot of the history is on that, in that book.
Is the reason the Palestinians haven't continued that work simply because they don't have, if you will, the disposable resource to be able to do it, or is it the unique resource?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, people don't think of archaeology as your bread and butter. And in a time of occupation and many other concerns and just peace, you know, the struggle for peace, archaeology is sort of far down the list. And a Westerner, as a gift, could do it. Mm-hmm. And he was also collaborating on a book called All That Remains. It's a book which documents the 600 Palestinian villages which were bulldozed in 1948 as Israel took up its territory. They tried to wipe out every trace. Problem is, Palestinians have used cactus as a living hedge between their houses. And you can bulldoze cactus from here to Kingdom Come, but you don't get the spores out of the soil. So the cactus comes back. And so wherever on the hills of Palestine, of Israel, let's say, Israel proper, so to speak now, you find these crossworks of cactus fencing. It's one of the signs of these villages. And he and some other people were documenting the place of these 600 villages. I went to one of these sites, which may have been the biblical Emmaus, with a Palestinian resident who grew up there. And he stood next to a huge reef of cactus, which was now back to 9, 10, 12 feet tall and 40 yards long and had been bulldozed at one point. And he said, if these cactus could speak, they would know me. And it's that kind of thing that was the lifeblood, really, of Al's work, to try to show that justice is served when the claims of both people to this land is recognized. And he paid for it with his life. If that much of a review will stand us in enough stead to continue, let's take a little bit of a look at this. What is the impact of our taxes? Tithes, essentially, relief, teaching, some awareness building. We'll leave it at that. If we look at our taxes, first of all, the U.S. Is not very generous with its foreign aid. We're the least of the industrialized countries of the world in what we give of our governmental budget, federal budget, for foreign aid. The folks who elected the new Congress were polled by the University of Maryland as they left the polling booth, and their average answer for how much of our budget we give to foreign aid was 27%. Okay. They said, when they were leaving, how much is 20% of it? And they said, 25, 20, 30%. No, so they came with 27%. When you asked them how much they thought they should give, they said 5%. When you asked the general public how much foreign aid is, it says 15%. Okay, so it's not 25, it's not 15, what the general public thinks. It's not 5, what we sort of say we should give as a rich country. It's 1%, and actually the humanitarian part is 0.5%, all right? Because in the 1% comes the State Department's budget and all kinds of other things related to foreign affairs.
Does that include weapons to Israel and everything?
Yeah, in this 1% is weapons to Israel.
Which is over half of that, isn't it?
Exactly, you want to take over here? This is exactly it. It's my best line.
Okay, Jonathan, why don't you give us your best line?
This includes weapons to Israel. Okay, not this, but this.
How much of that is good?
You can go now. The tragedy is that we have been taking this 1%, which is a lot of money in real terms, but a small amount of money in relative terms. We've been taking that, and we've been giving as much as 50% of it every year for the past couple decades to Israel.
Good Jewish lobbyist.
Yeah, sad to say. All my neighbors are Jewish, and it's great living there. We're getting to know them and enjoying our life in New York City. But this is not a very helpful figure.
No.
And it includes Israel and Egypt, because Camp David was a peace that you buy. We bought peace between Israel and Egypt, a bilateral peace. Two of the part players in the region, and everybody else pays the bill. We pay the bill, the Palestinians pay the bill in destruction and occupation. The Lebanese pay the bill in occupation. The Syrians pay the bill in no contact. The Jordanians pay the bill and have now had to make some peace of their own. Everybody else pays for that. So 50%, it's now down to 40% in 1993, before, down to 40%. Goes to Israel and Egypt, and the part Israel gets is cash and military supplies, and they do some interesting things with that money. This is one of the interesting things. They are able to do things like try to build a high-tech modern fighter plane using our money as a sort of a mini superpower. They think they can build their own jet. Well, it failed, but it cost $2 billion before they failed on it. They say, we don't use your money to settle settlers in the West Bank. But, you know, if somebody wants to do something and you give them money in their right hand, what are they going to do with the money in their left hand? I mean, it's a total hypocrisy to think that we aren't paying for the settlement of the West Bank. We are. I don't know how far to go with this, because you all got the punchline, and I think it's important to keep it in mind very, very clearly that our taxes do not do anything for peace. Somebody told me in the jacuzzi today, your talks get improved when you go to the jacuzzi. He said Noam Chomsky maintains that we aren't even part of the peace process in the Middle East because of the net effect of our actions in the area. What are we part of? Something else. We're part of the war process or the injustice process or something. The amounts are interesting. Every Israeli gets about $1,000 per year from America, if you spread it over the country. And Israel is a country richer than Greece or Portugal, some of the members of the European community. And yet that's the kind of level they get. If you add up all the costs of our aid to Israel since it was founded, this is true for no other country in the world by any stretch of the imagination, direct and indirect costs of our sort of unflinching, narrow-minded support of one party in a troubled region. George Ball, who spent a whole career in U.S. politics, and his son wrote a book about it and added it up, they came to a figure of $250 billion. The direct and indirect costs of our support for Israel. That works out at $50,000 per Israeli. Or, to turn it around, $1,000 from each one of you, just given to Israel. And it'd be great if it bought peace. But it hasn't bought peace. In fact, it's worked against peace. Art, yeah.
Of Breckman's point is, I remember being in Korea in 63 to 66, and that the U.S. foreign aid decree at that time was around $350 million a year. And that continued, and it's actually dropped off. Yet those are the people that went to Vietnam and fought with us, whether you like them or not. They and Australia were the two countries that stood by us. And
right.
Now you look at the independence of South Korea has and what they're doing within the world economy. And so for essentially a pittance, that's what we got. And this is money down a rat hole.
Yeah, this isn't what Jesse Elms is talking about, but it's what he should be talking about, I think. Another case on the benefits of foreign aid. We do more trade each year with South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Than all the aid we ever gave them in 30 years.
Yes.
You know, foreign aid can be used constructively. With Israel, it's another story. It's been cash and military grants. And what they do is, I'll say in a minute, they are able to take our aid 1 year and use it as a down payment on a weapons system. And the following payments will be paid by the grant in the next year, and the next, and the next. 5 and 6 years out is in hawk, essentially. They're buying things with money we're going to give them later. How'd you like to do that? You know, it's like giving you a credit card and then paying for everything you're going to do with it from here for the next 5 years.
What are the other industrial countries doing in taxes and ties to help other countries?
At the top of that list is countries like Denmark and Norway, good Lutheran countries. See, that's why the Lutherans have to do something about this in this country. And they're approaching the 0.7% of GNP, which is a rich country's agreement that you should try to give 1% away. They dropped it to 0.7% of GNP.
Isn't Japan's over 2% now? 2.8%, 2.4%?
I don't think so. They're giving the most money in absolute terms, but not percentage-wise be that high. The highest in the world is Norway or Denmark, almost every year.
And so the figure for the U.S. is on the GNP?
No, this is percent.
That's on our taxes. No, I'm sorry.
This is percent of the federal budget.
Okay, federal budget. Okay, what percent of our GNP then?
I worked it out once. It's something like this, 0.016 of a percent. I mean, I may be wrong, but it doesn't even show on the graph. It doesn't even show on the graph of GNP. I mean, we have an enormous economy. Our advertising industry is bigger than the economies of all but, say, 10 countries in the world or 15 countries. I mean, there are scales here that just don't add up at all. Anyway, more's the pity that if we're just going to do a little bit, we do this with it. And the one more comment here is, in this year of foreign aid cuts, and they're going through, Clinton, I hope, will veto them, but what will happen then? He'll have to make a compromise. In this year of foreign aid cuts, Israel and Egypt weren't touched a bit. The cuts come for sub-Saharan Africa. The poorest people are cut the most. The richest people aren't touched. Does it sound like somebody's tax cut plan?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Up here. Do other countries also have this kind of giving relationship with Israel too, or it seems like the U.S. is certainly the biggest.
Yeah.
Are there other countries also that...
so generous to them?
Yeah.
West Germany has paid a lot of sort of guilt money to them. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest one I know of. Beyond that, France, there's a big Jewish community in France. Beyond that, I don't know of anybody who's real big.
For example, would Japan consider Israel a place to...
Japan doesn't give a hoot about Israel. They don't give them anything, I don't think. They're more interested in Iran and the oil. And,
What's interesting is the Jewish community as a community of givers and tithers, and they give a huge amount to Israel also.
Exactly. You know, we've given them up to $5 billion. There's another $3 or $4 billion in some years. I think the total this year is $7 billion. So $4 plus $3, $7 billion. The $3 billion extra is coming from the private sources.
They're very generous.
United Jewish Appeal, mm-hmm. All these wonderful charities to help the Jewish brothers and sisters. Yeah. Mary, please don't be afraid to take my next punch off.
I think it's in our self-interest in a way to do everything we can to enhance the Palestinian cause, because it's my understanding that they have the highest level of education per capita of any group of people in the world.
Exactly.
And that really surprised me. But if they ever get their act together or get their land, I think they are going to be a power to be reckoned with. I mean, they are very, very bright people.
Yeah.
And they treasure education and do everything they can to get advanced degrees. I mean, you tend to think of Arabs as kind of, a stereotype, but that's just not true.
No, they show what an Arab is when it has an education and a will to succeed. They call themselves the Jews of the present day. I mean, they're struggling the same way the Jewish people have struggled in diaspora. Another comment is, in my time around the place, I always think that the four most dynamic peoples in the world, for whatever reason, are the Jewish people, the Armenians, the Lebanese, and the Palestinians. I mean, if you see what they do when they're in a community, boy. And they're all the Middle Easterners. They're all Middle Easterners. Could you switch on that machine again? If there's no other comments, what I'd like to show you in a second here is the other end of the bookend. What happens at the intersection of taxes and tithes today. And this little film was made by the Middle East Council of Churches a couple years ago to take up an issue that is trying to take up something with some real substance, not just to bash Israel on the head. I need this down, don't I? Not to sound like we're, you know, we're a broken record, but to pick an issue that shows the human cost of the occupation and also doesn't leave the people at the level perhaps that you might have felt in the first video. The Palestinian people and the Arab society in general has a great deal of trouble with handicapped people. If you have a handicapped child, chances are, and I know social workers who've discovered this, they come into a home, they know there's a handicapped child there, it's chained up in the back room. Doesn't get out. You're allowed to marry cousins under Islamic custom. And so you produce more, perhaps, of these kind of birth irregularities and so on. And it's just a denial of handicapped problem. What we found, what's clear as day when you're there, is that there's a special problem now because of all the young men in the prime of life who have taken a bullet in their spine or their head during the Intifada, during the uprising against the Israeli occupation. And ironically, they are the heroes 1 minute. They're celebrated as they are wounded, and perhaps for days or weeks afterwards. And then before long, they find themselves in the same boat as the child that was born deformed. And they find their society forgetting about them. So you have an issue which, in a way, puts everybody on the dock. It calls attention to the dilemmas of war, on the one hand, of occupation, and also of a society that really has not taken the problem of handicapped people and their rights and what they need to have a go to heart. So let me show you some of this. It's called Disabled for Palestine. And you'll hear in it a Christian doctor named Nasri Khoury. He's from Jordan. He's one of the many Palestinians who had to flee Palestine when in 67, when Israel expanded. He had already fled from his 48 home. He's in Amman, Jordan. He's a Canadian-trained neurosurgeon. And every summer, the only Palestinian neurosurgeon who can be used by poor Palestinians has to take a vacation. So Nasri comes from Amman and replaces this Muslim neurosurgeon in a Muslim hospital, supported with Saudi money, as a Christian 1 month duty that he does to try to be there during the month of July or August. And during the Intifada, a neurosurgeon was worth his weight in gold because, as you'll see, what this film tries to do is go back and visit a few of the people who were injured 2 and 3 years ago. What happened to them 2 and 3 years down the pipe? Go back and meet them and see where their life is today. And as I say, it's an intersection between taxes and tithes because on the one hand you have people shot by bullets that you and me paid for. And that's as simple as that. You know, the Israeli army, we paid for their bullets. And then people healed, or at least partially healed, by Nasri Khoury and folks like that who are working in clinics and hospitals that are supported by the Christian community overseas as well.
Since the occupation of 1967, there has been a gradual deterioration in health services for many reasons, but all those reasons are related to the occupation. given the circumstances, the services that are given are phenomenal. They are heroic. But that doesn't mean that they are ideal. They face a lot of shortages, they face a lot of problems.
Dr. Nasr Khoury is a Palestinian living in the diaspora. As a neurosurgeon, his skills are much needed in the occupied territories, especially since the Intifada began. He's here to relieve the only neurosurgeon at the largest hospital in the West Bank. Today he is visiting a clinic for spinal cord injuries. A month ago, during a strike in Nablus, Ahmad Lebedi, a bystander, was shot from behind. Before this clinic opened in 1990, such cases often went without rehabilitation or long-term care after their surgery. Life expectancy at home was as little as 2 or 3 years.
I'm concerned with those to the nervous system, since the nervous system doesn't have the ability to heal, so that there's a lot of disabilities that have resulted from nervous system injuries, brain, spinal cord, peripheral nerves. In the first part of the Intifada, in the original stages of the Intifada, there was a lot of mass demonstrations, confrontations with the army, and we used to see a very large number of injuries.
5 years of struggle against occupation have cost Palestine more than 1,000 lives. These are civilians, and according to the Palestine Human Rights Information Center, for each one killed by the soldiers, 125 others are injured. The 1992 average was 20 injuries per day. Casualties are in the prime of life. Serious cases each day add to the ranks of the permanently disabled. 3 years ago, Sabah Sabatin's car was stopped at a roadblock. Stones were thrown and her husband began to drive off. The soldiers fired. She's spending the rest of her life in a wheelchair.
لما دخلت البيت في هذاك المشوار يعني تصورت حالي غريبة غريبة ولا قاعد نعمل من فات البيت.
Can you read the subtitles?
Yeah. وبعدين برضه وأنا في المستشفى يعني جوزي تجوز برضه من وقتها. وشو يعني بالنسبة لحياتي أنا يعني أو وجودي في البيت عايبة وكنت مستوى يعني مش مأثر موجودة أو مش موجود نفس الشيء. شو يعني بكيت؟ بقول لك بكيت ست بيت بمعنى الكلمة يعني ست بيت أو بس أنا بقول إن هذا القضاء والقدر ورغم إنه هو اللي طحني يهودي أو جندي أو اللي هو صدقني يمكن ما حقدت عليه نهائيا ليش؟ لأني أنا أول عتالي مؤمن إني بدي أصير بس هو أجل السبب.
نظرة مجتمعنا العربي الفلسطيني محليا للمقاتل من تجربتك الثلاث سنوات؟
والله أنا من خلال تجربتي في هذول الثلاث سنوات بالنسبة لمجتمعنا إحنا العربي بنظروا للمقعد للأسف يعني بأن مش إنسان حتى ما بحسش لأن مطلوب منه هذا إنسان قصر هذا إنسان صار مقعد خلاص مطلوب منه يقعد في هالكرنة وما يحنسش لا في عمي ولا في خالي لا يروح لا يجي لا يسأل لا يحكي لا يخطط لا يكذب ولا بالنسبة لأي إشي في الدنيا يعني بديش يحس ولا في أي شيء.
شو هو المستقبل بالنسبة لصباح؟
الله الله أعلم المستقبل شو مخبي والأيام شو مخبية. بقدرش الواحد هيني بكيت عمري في يوم من الأيام قلت بدي أقعد القعدة هذي بكتش بكتت عين على البال ولا عمر معقول قلنا من الشيطان الرجيم لو كل الناس تقعد ما بكتش أفكر إن أنا راح في يوم من اليوم من الأيام أصير فيها هيك أو أقعد القعدة هذي مش ممكن. وهي يا ربنا قدر وصارت شو بدنا.
I'll just go ahead to another case. This man was a karate player, shot 3 years ago. After his surgery, which his father is describing here how he was shot, after his surgery, he didn't get any further care. And Nasri visiting him said, he's going down, down. In about 3 years, he could be dead himself again. Because you can't live without, there's the karate. You can't live without rehabilitation.
As well as helping families and friends to cope. One who is getting the therapy he needs after surgery, so far at least, is Ahmad Jabbar. His bullet wound and beating happened only 4 months ago. Already Ahmad is hoping to go back to school and continue sixth grade.
فتيون مضربت طخوا علي
طخوا عليك رصاص وصلت في رصاص؟
اه وين؟ موت فات من هون تراب من هون بعدين ضربوني
بعد ما طخوك اجوا عليك ضربوك؟
اه ضربوني على رجلي خاطر كده خربش على صدري ورموني بين بلاطين على الجبال
شو صار فيك انت؟
3 ساعات وننزل دم والحمد لله أظن
When the agency Save the Children documented how many children were being shot, tear gassed and beaten, the numbers of young casualties dropped for a while. But that was in 1990. Children's stones are still being met with bullets. And it's not only that violence against Palestinians puts heavy demands on medical services. 25 years under occupation has already crippled those services. In 1967, there were 12 government hospitals. Today, there are 9, and the population has grown by 500,000. This unfinished hospital in Nablus was turned into a prison. Another in East Jerusalem has become a police headquarters. Non-government hospitals are frustrated in efforts to fill the gap. The occupation authorities tax them, deny building permits and block gifts of medicine and equipment. And over the years that Palestinian institutions have been crippled, Israel has received billions of dollars in foreign aid, notably from the United States, strengthening the government and army responsible for the occupation and its violence.
Someone hit the little button at the back of that projector on top. I think just a point on the score there is that that little summary which said that in 25 years of occupation the medical system has gone down. And we can only think in terms of peace as the ultimate medical solution, as the doctor goes on to say in the piece. Yeah, Art.
Jonathan, in the last 4 years, what has Israel done for America?
Well, Reagan called them an aircraft carrier for us in the Middle East.
Oh, that's handy. I mean, but what have they done for us?
I don't know. I think we have an obligation to guarantee their security, but I think it's obviously gone a lot farther than that.
It helped guarantee the security of Portugal, too.
Yeah. What I'd like to do in the little time we have left is sort of finish this equation. Obviously, if there's only, as somebody said this morning, only like one point in a lecture at Holden, it's sort of like taxes plus tithes do not equal peace in the Middle East, and it's 50 years of this. And it's kind of a long and rather sad story if you are the people who are still in this circumstance after all that time. Part of the role of the churches, I think, in this country becoming increasingly more important, especially during the Intifada, and the trick now is to say, let's not forget it, just because somebody shook hands on the White House lawn. Let's look at what's happening. Look past the agreements and the politics of the peace process and look at what's happening on the ground. Israel likes to say it's creating facts on the ground, and that's in fact the case. They are occupying the West Bank in ways that haven't yet even begun to be discussed. They control 2/3 of the West Bank and 40% of Gaza. Let's look at changes in those kind of indices of land, water, and the status of Jerusalem and the freedom of people. Remember, there are as many Palestinians outside the country as there are inside the occupied territories in Israel. What's going to happen to them? Are they totally forgotten? Those tent cities you saw at the beginning in that film, Healing from the Holy Land, many of them are now in the same place they were then, but they're cement tent cities now. They are cement refugee camps. You can look over a valley near Amman, Jordan, and see 50,000 in one camp of just cement tents. Well, I wanted to point to something a little brighter and a little bit more forward-looking. It's this toward a safer future for all the children of Abraham, and present it very briefly as an example of church-based advocacy for peace. Churches who are pitting their meager tithes against Uncle Sam's ample taxes and coming up short through 50 years, saying that enough of this, we're only credible in these ministries if we also look at the bigger picture. What this task force came up with, and everybody of a similar mind, Lutheran World Relief is there, World Vision, Washington office, very strong on the Middle East, not as Christian Zionists, American Near East Aid Committee, CARE, the Quakers, a whole page here of the groups Bread for the World behind this document, which came out in January, came out 2 or 3 months after the election, came out after foreign aid was already being slashed. Sort of a pathetic proposal in the face of what is being done to foreign aid. Not that it's not a good proposal, but in the context in which it arrived, it is. And what it's recommending is these four things: promoting confidence-building measures. Our foreign aid to the Middle East should do these four things. Number one. Number two, achieve some kind of military reduction. It's the most heavily militarized area in the world. It's some incredible percentage of arms sales are to the Middle East, and who's selling them? We are, and the French are, and the British are. Number three, sustainable development for the region as a whole, and national and regional economic integration. I'll just give you three examples, one under each of those things. The first one, confidence building measures. Remember, this is for all the children of Abraham. Abraham had Isaac, and Isaac had Jacob and Esau, right? Jacob became the Jewish line, Esau became the Arab line, Ishmael, and in there. The Christians as well, from the Jewish line, the Jews and the Muslims, all of Abraham's children, not just his Jewish children. Peace, a brighter future for all of them. They can't help but live together. Promoting confidence-building measures, it suggests withdrawing military forces from the West Bank, from the south of Lebanon, still occupied by Israel, a security zone they call it, from the Golan Heights. Resettlement of refugees to mutually agreed locales, not just settlement of new Jewish settlers. Any Jew in the world can go to the West Bank and get a funded housing, an education, a swimming pool, a theater, and a shopping mall. And any Palestinian who was born and raised there has no rights to the same land. Any Russian Jew or South African Jew or French Jew or American Jew can come in and have that land, and yet the Palestinians born and raised there cannot stay on that same land. That's what we're talking about here when we talk about refugees and some of the things at stake. Resettlement of Israeli settlers from the West Bank, from Gaza, and from the Golan Heights. And remember, 1/3 of the settlers are willing to go home for a little money. We got money. Let's use it for that. Let's buy out the settlers. Bring them back home. It could be done with raw dollars, I'm almost sure. An example of military reductions, that practice I mentioned where Israel can put a down payment on an expensive weapons system with this year's aid and pay off the payments with next year's aid and the next year's and the next year's. It's a credit line that we extend to them that no other country in the world has ever received in those quantities. Sustainable development. Only 13% of our economic aid for that region goes to things like education, primary health care, safe drinking water, sanitation, nutrition, family planning. Only 13% of our aid for the whole region goes for that. How about spending some money on those kind of things? The study also recommended, finally, regional infrastructure. And the best example there is water. The countries of the Middle East are almost all under some kind of water shortage. When you're with a family in Amman, Jordan, you really think twice about whether you should flush the toilet, because it may wipe out what they have left in their tank, and the water may not come again for 2 more weeks. And they'll never tell you in good Middle Eastern hospitality, but you know, you have to think of these things.